This podcast is intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. A quick note. There are two available versions of this podcast, one in English as a red note and Spanish as La Nota Roja. If you would prefer to listen in Spanish, you can do so by searching for La Nota Roja in the same podcast app where you downloaded or streamed this episode. The femicide in Juarez is an important story that has never been presented in this way before. To allow English-speaking audiences to hear testimony from families of the victims and Mexican investigators and journalists who studied these events, some interviews have been translated into English by Mexican voice actors. From Imperative Entertainment, this is The Red Note. Let's begin the program.
It's 1995. The bombing of a federal office building in Oklahoma City.
The side of the federal building has been blown off.
Leaves more than 800 dead or injured. Microsoft's Windows 95 operating system sells 1 million copies in its first 4 days. Cementing the digital age as a permanent fixture in American life.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder upon Nicole Brown Simpson.
In Los Angeles, football star O.J. Simpson is acquitted in the murder of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson. And on the other side of the border, the serial murders of women in Juarez are entering their third year. At the time, Oscar Maynez was a forensic pathologist in the Chihuahua Attorney General's office and a professor training homicide detectives at the State Police Academy. Maynez had begun to use actual cases in his lessons to help the cadets understand the process of interpreting evidence in a real-life investigation. While he was perusing the backlog of cases in the police's files, Maynez came across several that caught his attention.
When I started working in the State Police Academy, I requested homicide cases to try to train investigating agents on how to approach a homicide investigation, and during that exercise, I noticed several cases of women who were murdered and who had a pattern. That's when I realized that something more organized was happening in Ciudad Juarez.
Over the previous 2 years, dozens of women had been viciously murdered just a few miles from the U.S. border in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. Their bodies were found later, almost unrecognizable, after weeks or months under the desert sun. Authorities had been slow to recognize the serial nature of these killings, but by 1995, it was becoming undeniable that a series of female homicides was taking place. Journalist Teresa Rodriguez writes in her book, Daughters of Juarez, that many of the victims were found with an identical pattern of injuries. They had been raped and strangled, with their necks broken. They were stabbed, their right breast severed, and their left nipple bitten off. To Maynez, this looked like a signature. Evidence that a single killer was behind the murders.
The profile of the victims was usually young, lower-class women, factory workers, students. The first victims were carefully selected because it was very difficult to identify them, since most of them would be migrants, people who came from other parts of the country looking for a job, or in a process of migrating to the United States. So there was no network of friends or family who would immediately miss them, and who filed a missing persons report. In the cases that I personally attended to, many of the bodies we located were only skeletal tissue already. It was rare to find bodies with enough tissue as to accurately establish the cause of death. But everything points to sexual assault and strangulation.
As he dug deeper, Maynes uncovered more cases that shared the same signature. He compiled a report about his serial killer theory with a profile of the suspect.
That report basically explained that it was the classic lone serial killer. What is the process of this type of homicides? Why I think that phenomenon is occurring in Ciudad Juarez? I warned the authorities at the time that we had to act before this got out of hand. It would have been necessary to create a team of researchers who would focus on establishing patterns, on matching victims, on trying to anticipate what the evolution of the phenomenon would be, on trying to get ahead of things, tracing the murderer or murderers. I tried to reach the prosecutor. I delivered the report to his assistant, but basically, no. They paid no attention to it. First of all, they denied the issue, then they minimized it, then they blamed the victims. And the next logical step was to fabricate culprits.
This is episode 2 of The Red Note, The Juarez Reaper. My name is Lydia Cacho.
Our house is a mess. Come on in.
I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
During the 90s and 2000s, Lorena Figueroa was a reporter for El Diario de Juarez, the city's largest newspaper.
All reporters, everyone I think that reported Juarez in the 90s and early 2000s, we all had to cover femicides. I remember my first body, the first body that I saw, there was in the back of a car. And those, like, it looked like the 1970s, those where you put the dead bodies on, and then it's back in like a sort of a car, but it was from the judicial, from the state police. Photographers came first before than police to just put the like yellow tape around the body. And I saw this girl, she had her face covered and she was in her uniform. And she was around 13. And they had her in the car because back in the day, well, the justice system or police, or they didn't work as they work today. They were not that, I don't want to say professional, but like how to recover a body, how to, you know. I was like kind of shocked on how young this girl was.
In the 2 years since the first reported victim was found in the deserts outside Juarez, authorities had failed to commit any meaningful resources to solving the femicides. The lack of scientific training and proper criminal investigations created a vicious cycle of ignorant policemen destroying or contaminating evidence and treating the victims as mere objects. The investigations that were carried out by the authorities were largely pro forma affairs, with little sense of urgency on the part of the investigating officers. Evidence became misplaced or contaminated, witnesses were ignored, leads weren't followed up, and basic evidentiary procedures were sidestepped, leading to the misidentification of numerous victims. Journalist Blanca Carmona.
The prosecutor's office, they're not interested in bringing justice to the victims. They're interested in saying, we're working, it's okay. There are murders, but we did our work. They do fast-track investigations, but they don't really care about people as human beings to give them justice. Maybe it's also fair to acknowledge that within the government, there are people who do try to do their job, trying to get results. We found a detective that was very committed, and he said to us with sadness, look, when we had located a very strong line of investigation, which has nothing to do with the detainees, our bosses told us, stop it now. Don't follow this any further. You'll get in trouble. You'll get killed. There are people inside who want to do the job, and they won't let them. They simply can't, because they're afraid of being killed, afraid of losing their jobs. There are people who come to the office every day and grab their files and go out to work and can deliver results, but sometimes they don't have the right equipment. They don't have the job security, because they know they can get in trouble if they really get to the truth.
Veronica Corchado is the head of In Mujeres, the Municipal Women's Institute in Juarez. She says that the cost of these investigative failures wasn't only judicial. For the families of the victims, it was intensely personal as well.
Let's not forget that in the cases from 93 until around 2004, 2005 or so, many of those files were lost. And the photographs the DA's office requested back then were lost along with the file. The families were asked for a photograph and then, bring me another picture because that one doesn't look good, and then bring me another photograph, and they were left without any photos. This was a big family calamity. It wasn't like now that mothers would easily take pictures of their daughters, their children. Many of these women were left without photographs, and that means losing their face. I worked with a mother. There's a phrase that hit deep inside me. This photograph from the investigation is all I have. I don't have any other. That seems very painful to me, whether we're mothers or not, to forget someone. their features and all. I mean, it's a testimony that she existed, that she was, that she felt. And to lose that to them and to anyone else, is dramatic.
By and large, authorities blamed the victims for their own abduction and murder. They were out late, wearing God knows what, probably up to no good. What did they expect to happen to them? Female reporters began to talk not just about the lack of empathy among the police chiefs, but how they clearly despised the lives and dignity of these women and girls. Lorena Figueroa.
Even when someone is disappeared, you have to understand also that mothers get victimized. What was your daughter doing? How was she dressed? What was she doing at 8 o'clock at nine in the street? What were you?
Oscar Maynes.
I remember a very interesting case where they found the killer of a 12-year-old girl. Then when the press was confronting Francisco Barrio, they asked him, hey, this is a girl who was, she was in elementary school, right? She's 11 years old. How are you going to blame her of being up to no good? And the governor's response was, oh, but her bones were decalcified. And that was it. Basically, this girl was malnourished. She didn't drink enough milk. So he was essentially blaming the parents. Because of their lack of resources, because the fact that she's poor justifies what happened to her, right?
The primary concern for authorities was the political ramifications of the crimes. Families and activists were angrily starting to demand answers. But with city elections more than 2 years away at the start of the murders, there was little political incentive for authorities to dedicate resources to solving these cases. Journalist Rocío Gallegos says,
impunity means that anyone can try to kill. And we've seen it. We saw it in the Vicente León famous case. The boy who killed his family, who convinced his friends to help him kill his father, his mother, and his sister. And he was saying, when they arrested him after their investigation, he said, I just never imagined that you would find out it was me, because I see on the news that they kill and throw away the bodies and nobody knows who did it.
With every death and every disappearance, the fears that many residents had dismissed for 2 years took tighter and tighter hold on the city. In the 1990s, Irene Blanco was working in the mayor's office in Ciudad Juarez.
There was already a terrible discomfort. It was society mass panicking. That's what was going on. Every day, another and another. People beginning to ask the government what they were doing about it. The organizations that we had here of feminists or activists starting to demand answers from the government about what was going on. Because it happened every other day. It was really outrageous.
For working-class families with young daughters, these fears were multiplied tenfold. Every missed bus home from work, every unscheduled visit with friends, stoked fears that their daughters might have become the next victim. Authorities refused to consider these women officially missing until several days had passed since their disappearance. So many families launched a frantic search when their daughters were late returning home, afraid that their girls would become another statistic if they didn't act quickly. José Luis Castillo's daughter, Esmeralda, disappeared in 2009.
When a girl doesn't come back, since we're here in Ciudad Juárez, and there's this situation, her parents go crazy. Because we let 48 hours go by. In 48 hours, unfortunately, the girls could be already dead.
With authorities refusing to take action, more and more women and girls were murdered or disappeared in Juárez. July of 1995, 15-year-old Silvia Morales goes missing after work. Police assure her family that their daughter had probably run off with a boyfriend. Morales' body is found on the outskirts of the city 2 months later, raped and strangled in an area known as Lote Bravo. One of her breasts had been severed. On the other, the nipple was bitten off. August, the body of 17-year-old Elizabeth Castro is discovered in Lote Bravo. She had been raped and strangled. When she is found, her wrists are still bound with shoelaces. The killer had carved a mark on her back in the shape of a triangle. September. The bones of Olga Alicia Carrillo Perez are found by the side of a highway in Lote Bravo. Her body is so badly damaged after exposure to the elements that there is not enough tissue to perform DNA tests. Many of the victims shared a similar look. Long, dark hair, bangs slightly curled, thin, and beautiful. It seemed as if the killer had a certain type, or that the victims were being selected by their killers based on certain physical characteristics. Rumors began to circulate about a Lote Bravo rapist who was hunting the women of Juárez. The sexualized nature of many victims' wounds led some feminists to ask whether these women were being used for snuff porn. Families began looking at their daughters, asking whether their girls might be in danger because they looked like the ones who were being murdered. By the fall of 1995, with city elections just a few months away, authorities got their first break in the case. Teresa Rodriguez writes that a prostitute named Blanca went to police and told them she had been kidnapped and raped over several days at a home in a wealthy Juárez neighborhood. During the 1990s, Vicky Caraveo was an activist in Ciudad Juárez.
The girl who managed to escape through the bathroom, he had her in a residential development called San Marcos. She manages to get out through the bathroom after 72 hours of captivity and not sexual abuse, but sexual savagery. Because he did things to her in every part of her body. He beat her, he raped her where he could and where he couldn't. She managed to escape, and she arrives at the house of a very beautiful woman and asks her for help. And this person, she forgot the fear, she forgot about everything and took her to get medical care.
Blanca led police back to the house, not far from where Elizabeth Castro's body had been found a few months before. It belonged to a man named Abdel Latif Sharif Sharif.
49-year-old Sharif had emigrated to the United States from Egypt in the 1970s. He was a talented chemical engineer and inventor who had made millions through patents that he developed for the oil companies where he worked. Oscar Maynes.
I remember he was very smart because he tried to. He called me over because he wanted to have a conversation, and we spoke in English for a while. A few months after that, he asked me to speak with him, and he spoke Spanish already. I mean, he caught on fast, intellectually speaking. He was very smart.
Sharif had been fired by his employers after being charged with a series of sex crimes in the U.S. In 1981, he served 45 days in a Florida jail for sexual assault. In 1983, he was sentenced to 12 years in prison for the vicious beating and rape of a nursing student. After he was paroled for good behavior, Sharif settled in Texas. He was arrested soon after on drunk driving charges. Facing deportation to Egypt, his lawyers reached a deal with the prosecutor. Sharif would agree to leave the country voluntarily in exchange for having the charges against him dropped. He left Texas and went to work at his new employer's maquiladora in Ciudad Juarez. In Mexico, Sharif became a regular in the city's nightclubs. Noa Noa, where the legendary Juarez singer Juan Gabriel had made his name, and the bars of the city's nearby red light district. After police showed up at his house, Sharif was arrested and charged with raping Blanca. But then she began receiving death threats. Terrified of Sharif, Blanca was equally fearful of the police, who she said had raped her at the station when she went to report Sharif's assault. To save her own life, Blanca fled to her home in Veracruz, and Sharif was released. Then the authorities started looking into Sharif's background. They learned about the multiple arrests for rape and assault, the jail sentence, the deportation procedure. They spoke with witnesses in the city's red light district. A stripper named Erica told police that she had introduced Sharif to several of her friends. She was shocked when Sharif allegedly told her that after sleeping with the women, he had murdered them and buried their bodies in the desert. Other witnesses reported that they had seen Sharif with some of the other murdered women, including 17-year-old Elizabeth Castro. El Paso Times reporter Diana Washington Valdez.
There were several factors that made Sharif an ideal suspect. First and foremost was his background of sexual assault and crimes against women in Florida. He had a string of cases there where he had become known by the police as a man who was violent toward women. He also was as a suspect, someone who was isolated. He didn't have any friends or didn't have a network in Mexico that could help him.
After Sharif relocated to Juarez,
he attracts attention because here he is, he's a party animal. He's extroverted. He goes into the nightclubs of Juarez Avenue, and he's dancing and just carrying on, and he catches a lot of attention. The authorities are under a lot of pressure to solve these crimes. They're starting to get people from media and from other countries. It was just a lot. And the demonstrations and the protests and, you know, stop this, the higher authorities, the business community, we need to put an end to this. So Sharif comes on the scene. They delve into his background. and they decide he's the one. He's the one.
Acting on Erica's statement, Sharif was again taken into custody and charged with the murder of Elizabeth Castro. Over the following months, Sharif would be tied to the deaths of at least 12 more women in Juarez. Investigators told the press that the Egyptian might be behind even more of the murders. Here is Irene Blanco.
You're too young to have heard about this. But if you read the press from that time, it was one case after another. I would ask, how many are Sharifs? Sharif, Sharif, Sharif? They were all Sharifs. They even started removing some because they were from before Sharifs.
Sharif claimed that authorities were forcing witnesses to make false statements to implicate him in the femicides. But the press ignored Sharif's allegations. Headlines trumpeted the arrest as a major breakthrough in the serial murders investigation. Juarez residents, especially families with young daughters, felt like the city's two-year nightmare was finally over. The serial killer of Juarez, the Lote Bravo rapist, the Juarez Reaper, the monster, was finally behind bars. The case against Sharif appeared to be rock solid. Authorities had witnesses who had seen him in the company of multiple victims. They had second-hand testimony in which Sharif had confessed to several of the murders. And of course, they had Sharif's criminal record in the United States and his long history of violence against women. Oscar Maynes.
When they just told me they already had someone, an engineer from the Middle East, then the journalist I was talking to says to me, should I ask him some questions? Who is he? For how long? And he said, no, he arrived in Juarez on X date. He's not the one. Why not? Because the pattern of these murders is prior to his arrival in Ciudad Juarez. That means that this is not a guy. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, the wrong time for him because they presented a foreigner from a culture that is much more, even more sexist than ours. He certainly was an alcoholic, a misogynist, sometimes aggressive towards a woman. And yes, the guy would go to bars and try to pick up young girls. But the gap from that to being a serial killer, that's pretty much far-fetched, isn't it?
There is a hill in the northwest of Juarez, just a few feet from the U.S.-Mexico border, that looks down into a valley known as Lomas de Poleo. Two Mexican soldiers approach as you enter to ask what your business is. From a distance, with their uniforms and semi-automatic rifles, they look intimidating. Up close, you can see they are only boys, grateful for some company atop that lonely hill. Down below, a great valley stretches out for miles in every direction. To the north, the outskirts of El Paso. It's where the city's factories used to be and where its wealthiest residents now make their homes. To the south is Lomas de Poleo. Today, this area is a quiet neighborhood, but in the 1990s, it was a dangerous section of town. Dora Fensor is a longtime resident of Lomas de Poleo. Her daughter, Andrea, was found murdered in 2011.
I've been told that bodies have been found in some places down by the creek or here on the other side of the boarding school. I think it was like 8 days after I moved here, they found a man charred, abandoned in those towers over there with the power cables. And later, after that, more recently, maybe 2 or 3 years, some little girls were also found in the trunk of a car just uphill from here, from that house over there. Then a friend of my daughter, who was also killed by that street, and also 3 other young men who were murdered in the... You see, there's the tank behind that too.
Because of their isolation and easy access from the main road, the hills of Lomas de Poleo were a perfect place to abandon a body and make a quick getaway. In March of 1996, Juarez police discovered the remains of several women that had been dumped in Lomas de Poleo. The following month, they found more victims nearby. All were badly decomposed. The remains of several more women would also be found in the desert by the end of the year. The citizens of Juarez began asking themselves, if Sharif, the alleged perpetrator of the femicides, is behind bars, then why are these murders still taking place? Irene Blanco.
Reporters and journalists started saying, no, no, it doesn't add up. It makes no sense. They were the ones talking to me. No, no. They were up to something. The police here are covering for someone. And I talked, I think, to Esther Chavez Cano.
Esther was the founder of Casamiga, the first rape crisis center in Juarez.
I said, hey, Esther, because she was the one I trusted the most. Hey, Esther, I think we need to look at this in depth. There's a lot of things that aren't coming together and are wrong. Like what? Like the fact that Sharif is being accused and the deaths keep accumulating. Explain that to me. They are trying to end all the social panic that has to be calmed down. Here we get into them having a scapegoat. Because ultimately, he's a foreign person. He doesn't speak the language. It's perfect. It's ideal. As good as it gets.
The Red Note is a production of Imperative Entertainment. It was hosted by Lydia Gacho and written and directed by Craig Whitney. Executive producers are Jason Hoke and Lydia Gacho. Lead producer is me, Estefania Bonilla-Hernandez, and producers are Laura Caulfield, Will Wallace, and Craig Whitney. Research and interviews conducted by Alicia Fernandez. Sound recording by Nicolás Aguilar-Jiménez and designed by Javier Umpierrez. LA recording engineer is Tom Corcoran. Dubbing directed by Rebecca Gomez and performed by Isabel Ireland, Rona Fletcher, Arturo Mercado Jr., and Genaro Vasquez. Music composed by Michael Ramos. Abraham Buendia recorded the making of and stills. Our production fixer was René Nava. Production vans were provided by our drivers Arturo and Ricardo Baeza in Ciudad Juárez and in Mexico City by Hugo Ramos. The production accounting supervised by Viridiana Morales and performed by Miguel Torres at Global Entertainment Firm. Insurance provided by Jasmine Alba and Ricardo Carrillo at LCI Seguros. Lorena Olivares is assistant to the director. Legal services provided by Laura Caulfield in the US and in Mexico by Laura Marván at Marván Pitol Abogados. The production was coordinated by Minerva Bolaños and supervised by Héctor Subieta. The producers wish to thank Adam Embruzzo, Dr. Edgardo Buscaglia, Daniel Espinosa Ochoa, Mike Hisi, Adriana Montalvo, Tony Montanieri, and Maria Rosa Ochoa for their gracious help with this podcast. We would especially like to thank Luis Chaparro and Ikae Chituda at the Chihuahua Film Commission and the people of Ciudad Juárez for their hospitality and support during the production. If you enjoyed The Red Note, please rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you listen to. Thanks again for listening.
We are joined now by Alicia Fernandez, who conducted the interview with Irene Blanco we heard in today's episode. Alicia, what do you remember hearing about Sharif in the 1990s?
I was too young to remember the details of everything that happened back then, but I definitely do remember seeing Sharif on the news. Back in those days, to talk about him was to personify the horror. I was 13 or so in those days, and I couldn't imagine what exactly everybody said he was doing. But my mom said that he was a degenerate guy and a dangerous person for girls, so he should be in jail. Well, now she has another perspective, but at that moment was shocking. I think for society at the time made sense that a foreigner will be able to carry out those horrible acts, because people thought that it had to be an outsider that was committing that type of murders. People talk about the old Juarez as a safe place. They weren't exposed to crimes like this before, and social media did not exist then. So it was impossible for many families from Juarez to believe that somebody from the community was doing this.
Thank you, Alicia.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.